Baseball had a big drug problem in the 1980s. And Commissioner Peter Ueroth kicked a lot of players out of the league for using cocaine. But one enterprising minor league owner had the brilliant idea of putting a bunch of those disgraced players onto one team. What could possibly go wrong? Everything. Which makes Jason Thurston wonder,
why is this not a movie?
Hello and welcome to Why Is This Not a Movie, the podcast where we talk about a moment in history or a book or a story we can rip from the headlines and ask Hollywood why no one's ever put it onto the big screen. I'm Mike Vago, author and regular contributor to the AV Club, and this week I'm joined by Jason Thurston, who helped launch our parent website, subjectmedia.org, and also runs the television website, screenscholars.com, which gives you a daily rundown of what you need to watch. Jason and the rest of the Screen Scholars team is also launching a Screen Scholars podcast, which you can hear wherever you get your podcasts starting later this month. And you can listen to me talking about TV instead of movies on an upcoming episode. So, Jason, welcome to the show. And hey, it's all about the 1986 San Jose Bees and why they're the best worst team in the history of minor league baseball.
Let me start out with myself, actually, and why I love baseball. Growing up, long before anyone was really talking about Asperger's, there were two things I was obsessed with. I was obsessed with music charts and baseball stats. If you asked me a song from 1964, I could tell you what position it hit, how many weeks in the top 40. And baseball stats, I could tell you what a player like Don Hoke hit in 1960. I'm not proud of it, and I couldn't tell you it now, but... in any case, as I got older, music became more about the music itself, and baseball became more about its stories. And boy, does it have a lot of great stories. For me, baseball is infinity. As George Carlin pointed out in his classic baseball versus football routine, its foul lines go on to infinity, and with extra innings, the game could go on forever. It may never end. There's a great story by W.P. Kinsella, the writer of Shoeless Joe, the book that would become Field of Dreams. He had another book that was called The Iowa Baseball Confederacy, which didn't get quite as many, as much popularity. But I once read it actually when I was a little kid. I had found my father's Playboy. And there was this, you know, after, you know, doing what my little kid might do, I found these stories about baseball in there. And this was a story about this Iowa team. The baseball, actually the Chicago Cubs in 1906, traveled to Iowa to play a barnstorming team that the grandfather of the main character was on. The main character winds up in some sort of time warp, and he finds himself in 1906 as a member of a team playing this mythical game against the Chicago Cubs of the Tinker Evers Chance era. And the game, you know, it's epic. It goes through nine innings, still tied at 2-2. And then it goes on to hundreds of innings, and then to thousands of innings. The center fielder for the Iowa team is struck by lightning and it becomes the angel of death. The left fielder becomes Satan himself, and it goes on and on and on. And it's that sort of infinity that really made me fall in love with baseball, the idea that anything can happen. And when I pitch this to you, I actually want to do a whole group of baseball stories. I mean, baseball already has a ton of movies created around it. We mentioned Field of Dreams. There's Bull Durham and Bang the Drum Slowly. They're all fictional stories. But there's also Eight Men Out and 42 and Fear Strikes Out and Pride of the Yankees and The Rookie, which actually is sort of a precursor in my mind for your podcast. When I read the story of the 35-year-old teacher who decided to give a second go at baseball, I immediately said, that's going to be a movie. He would make the major leagues a couple years later with the Tigers. And a few years later after that, Dennis Quaid was playing him on the big screen. So anyway, back to my life. It's 1990.
Before you do, I feel like baseball, sort of among all sports, we attach this mythic quality to the players, which means we are compelled to tell these mythic stories like Field of Dreams. Yes. But even the ordinary stories feel mythic.
That's true. And that's really, that's what it's all about. And that's why I wanted to pitch you so many different stories. There was this guy, Rube Waddell, in 1911, who was just an oddball. And he would, if there was a fire truck that went by, he would run in the middle of a game off the pitcher's mound and chase the fire truck. The players would routinely find him curled up in a ball in a firehouse just because that made him happy. Opposing managers would put little bobbleheads on the side and would sort of bop them up and down, distracting him while he was pitching. Nevertheless, he was an amazing pitcher, one of the best of the time. He's in the Hall of Fame, but also bringing it back into the idea of movies and fiction and mythical. He also had a much darker side, and he would associate with gamblers and would go drinking. He loved to bartend. And, you know, he would also to really bring it up to mythic quality, he loved to help out in the town, the little town that he wound up in after baseball finally gave up on him. And one day he heard the sirens and loving fire trucks and loving firehouses. He went to see what was going on, and there was a big flood, and he grabbed the sandbags, kept building the barriers, and eventually he did it in his shirt. He wasn't really thinking about anything. He didn't have a coat on. And it was sort of a William Henry Harrison situation where, you know, he did all these things. He drew himself to save the town. And then years later, between the cold and all the drinking in his life and him not really having a plan, he would end up dying at the age of 31.
Wow.
Or thereabouts. And so, I mean, it's got passion. It's got crazy, bizarre oddities. And it's also got great tragedies. And there's a lot of things. Like, you've got the wife swapping in the 1970s, which would make an amazing movie. And we know why that didn't get made. Because I believe one of the pitchers has made sure that he will not give them the rights and that it will not get made.
I've written in my AV Club column about the, which actually ties into to today's episode, the cocaine scandal in the 80s where the Pittsburgh Pirates mascot was dealing coke out of the parrot head and was the dealer for like half the National League.
Yeah, he was a friend of Dave Parker. And Dave Parker just decided, okay, well, what's a way we can get this guy with the team? And he said, okay, well, how can we hide him in plain sight? Why don't we put him in a gigantic green parrot suit? And the Wikipedia page just called it Large Green Parrot. And for some reason, I just find that perfect. In any case, that is part of one of the many jumping points for how this actually happened. Without that scandal, the manager, general manager, and kind of owner of the San Jose Bees would never have gotten his grand scheme, his grand experiment that we're talking about now. A quick brief rundown of baseball major leagues for people who don't know. There are currently 32 major league teams. The minors are broken down into AAA, AA, and Single A. And each team has one AAA, one AA affiliate, and a bunch of Single A teams to develop its players. As of 2016, there were 42 of these teams. There might be fewer now, because they consolidated recently, but there are a lot of them, and there still are a lot of them, who aren't affiliated with any major league team. However, back in 1986, there were only the Miami Marlins, who have no relation to the current major league team, save for its name, and are San Jose Bees. Now's a good time to bring in one of our main characters, if not the main character, Harry Steve. He's the manager, the general manager, and kind of the owner, and he's sets himself up as the owner and introduces himself as the owner, but he isn't quite the owner of the 1986 San Jose Bees, and we'll get to that later. And he was in the mid-20s when he became involved with the Bees. The major 2016 Sports Illustrated anniversary article made a point of, about how he was a manager who did not really know baseball. And this is something that always kind of bothers me in movies, really bothered me with Bohemian Rhapsody, is when something is changed just for the sake of an unnecessary change. He lived his life, basically, he played baseball in high school. Pretty much every job that he ever had was around baseball. So they're stretching to make a point. But anyway, he was working towards a master's in sports administration at Biscayne University in Miami when he started working part-time promoting the minor league Miami Amigos. All these teams have such great names, too. The owner of that team purchased the Macon Peaches and asked Harry to come along with him. So Harry, Steve, quit school to do baseball full time as the assistant general manager of the Peaches. He tired of the manager turnover. There were five in that year. And in 1980, when Woody Kern, a nursing home magnate in the area, asked Harry to be the GM of his team, the San Jose Bees, he jumped at the chance. As the Expo season in 1982 was a dud and no parent team in sight, Kern and Steve both felt it was time to try something new.
They hit upon a shady plan in the vein of the GameStop stock shorting story. I don't really understand the particulars or how it works, so I'll just read it directly from the Sports Illustrated story that came out on the 30th anniversary. So at the time, Harry was earning $1,000 a month, and he told Kern, "We can't make it like this." Kern came up with an idea. "Why don't you lease the team off me?" Harry would pay Kern $25,000 a year and call himself the owner. He would pay all the bills, but keep whatever profit the team generated. It was totally illegal, Harry says, It's right there in the National Association Blue Book. But it didn't bother him, and it didn't bother me. Now, I don't know why that actually helps, but hopefully you do. But anyway, essentially, with one thing or another, Harry Steeve was the owner of the San Jose Bees, kind of. He decided, since he could not find an American baseball team to be affiliated with, he'd look for one in Japan and found a willing suitor in the Seibu Lions. The Lions would send the Bees 5 players a year, and for some reason I can't quite find in all I've read, an eccentric pitching coach named Hank Wada. He was also the team's acupuncturist and was known to slap his players if they did something wrong. This deal was actually a gold mine, as the first year they paid Steve $25,000 and $100,000 the following years. However, from 1983 to 1985, the team was still terrible in spite of the Japanese imports and still hemorrhaging money. Steve paid his $25,000 every year to Curran faithfully, but something needed to change. Something and inspiration came from an unlikely place, cocaine. This year, Major League Baseball writers did not vote a single player into the Hall of Fame, even though its all-time strikeout leader and its all-time home run leader were on the ballot. Baseball itself has distanced itself from the steroid players, and it always seemed a bit hypocritical to me, as drugs, especially if you include alcohol, have always been an integral part of baseball. In the 1970s, most players took amphetamines, known as greenies. Revving up was just a part of the game, and everyone turned a blind eye. However, things took a turn by 1980, as cocaine was intertwined with the sport. Everyone seemed to be doing cocaine. Lonnie Smith, who would play in the World Series in 1980, and with 3 other teams, which is one of my favorite little stats over his long career, was nicknamed Skates. And under those skates, he always wore Playboy socks with pockets to hide his cocaine. Outfielder Willie Akin snorted rails before both halves of a doubleheader, where he hit 2 home runs in each game. The National League stolen base king Tim Raines kept it in his batting gloves. Relief pitcher Rod Scurry at one point claimed an $100,000 a month habit. And the craziest story came from Scurry's Pirates, as we talked about earlier, where star Dave Parker got his drug dealer a job with the team as the mascot. But we went with that. It was a good place to hide in plain sight. In any case, he would eventually get caught, and the National Pass went on trial again. And the Pittsburgh Pirates drug trial in 1985 was when baseball decided to crack down. New commissioner Peter Uberoff, the hero of the 1984 Summer Olympics, took a hard line, banning 6 key players from baseball. And it wasn't just those players. While some players weren't explicitly banned, the word was out, and they were blackballed, which turned on a light bulb in Steve's head. Since they were drawing nearly roughly 700 fans a game, and they're having last pick at the buffet of young players, meant they had to go up against young future stars like Roberto Alomar and Dante Bichette with players who were barely getting by, they had very little chance to compete. He hit upon a sort of 2 birds, 1 stone plan. Air Bud was still about 11 years away, but he realized that while these players couldn't play for any major league organization, there was nothing in the rule book that said these guys could not play for his team, a team that was bound to no one but themselves. And with that, he went about getting his players. But first, who would be the manager? He was ready to hire a former Bees manager who, of course, had his own crazy baseball story. Frank Verity one-upped Moonlight Graham in that he was called up to the majors in 1953, and the Yankees in that game replaced Rizzuto at shortstop with him in the middle of the game. His chance for his first at-bat came around, and the right-handed batter heard his opposing manager say, "Time," and stopped to bring in a right-handed pitcher. Verity was fine with this. Then he heard his own manager, Casey Stengel, also say, "Time," and he was replaced. He would never reach the plate again, and he played 18 more years in the minors before joining the coaching ranks. At the last minute, though, Verdi balks and says he can't manage the team that year, and he suggests his son. Harry Steeve is not quite comfortable with this, so he balks at that and decides he'll run the team himself. By the end of the season, the younger Verdi would actually be the manager, but that's another story that we'll get to later. So, our first main character, in addition to Steve, of the players, I think the most interesting one, the most compelling story, comes from Mike Norris. And I'm starting with him because he could be in the movie, our second lead. He was drafted in 1973. He was a fireballing pitcher. And he finally made the majors in 1975 with the Oakland Athletics. Before his first start, he saw on the ground a little blue pill. He didn't know what it was. He threw it in the trash and asked another player about it. The player told him, "Well, yeah, that's an amphetamine. So, you know, if you want to try that, go ahead. We got a lot of them." And he just says no. and becomes the ninth pitcher to debut with a shutout with three or fewer hits. Actually, later year, he tried in 1978 or so, he did try amphetamines once. He pitched 2 2/3 innings. He said that he thought he was Nolan Ryan fireballing, striking out everyone. But in reality, he was backing up third base and home base in his own words, because they were just launching the ball into right field and center field, and he didn't last long and he hated it. So he's still pretty much straight and narrow. And in 1980, cocaine's biggest year, as it turns out, he also has a great year. And maybe that was partially because he wasn't doing cocaine. Unfortunately, in that same year, the Richard Pryor fire happened. And, you know, cocaine figures any news is good news, or, you know, as long as the story is getting out there, hey, cocaine. And if you're somebody who is inclined to do drugs, the message isn't that Richard Pryor almost burned himself to death. The message is, hey, I can smoke cocaine and get really, really high. And by 1982, Norris gives in. He decides to smoke it, and he is hooked. He also has arm problems, which also affects his story. But by 1985, while he's still under the Oakland A's contract, he's hardly played, and he's sort of going up and down between the minors. He decides, in a genius move, that he's going to play winter ball in the Dominican Republic. Then that did not work out either. Although Sandy Alderson, who is now the general manager of the New York Mets, so he's still around, came down to the Dominican Republic with a AAA contract. Norris did not want to hear about going to AAA. He felt insulted in what he calls the most important mistake of his life, along with cocaine. He turns him down. So he plays a little few games in the Dominican Republic. One day he wakes up. He does not know what happened the night before. He sees a naked woman he doesn't recognize next to him on the bed. And he's just completely mortified. I don't know if it was the same day, but he ends up getting arrested. He claims that the cops planted pot in his jacket. But I mean, that's, you can take the story as it will. He goes to the courthouse, does not know what's going on, and winds up getting sentenced to 6 months in jail. He does not know that that's what's happened, but he finds out later when the Oakland A's, in my mind at least, come crashing through the door and say, this is former Cy Young Award winner, Mike Norris. And so, you know, you've got to let him go. But at that point, he was not going to be pitching with the San Jose, at that point, he was not going to be pitching with the Oakland Athletics anymore. So that's how he became a B. Now, Ken Wright's is a much simpler story. He played third base in the 70s. He was a steady hitter, not a great one, a really good fielder. And he won a Gold Glove in 1975 and was always on the straight and narrow until 1981, when he said, oh, Coke, it's there. Sure, I'll try it. And in 1981, he played a few games and was quickly find himself in the minor leagues, bouncing around, chasing cocaine, and also sort of trying to somehow keep on with a baseball career that doesn't last very long. And when he thinks is the last chance, his father tells him about the San Jose Bees. He doesn't even know that it's a professional baseball team. He thinks he's going to a rec league team, like a California rec league team. And when he gets there, he's the most surprised of all. Then we come to Steve Howe, who's probably the most famous one of all of these players, and was kind of the poster child of drugs and baseball in the 1980s, as he just kept getting caught. He was the 1981 National League Rookie of the Year. That year, the Dodgers won the World Series, and it was pretty magical. But as the Naked Guns, the second sequel, would point out years later, when Frank Drebin is shaking somebody and says, I'll give you a second chance, and we don't mean a Steve Howe second chance. His struggles were so ubiquitous that joke, people understood what that joke was in 1992, I think it was about when that movie came out. So he winds up in the minors himself, bouncing around a ton of suspensions. And he winds up, of course, on the San Jose Bees. That's what we're talking about here. He's called Hauser, and he's probably most of what gets people to come down to San Jose to find out more about it. A couple more players from the drug side. Daryl Sconyers was the Angels' heir apparent to Rod Carew. In 1985, he asked permission to come to camp 3 days late. 17 days later, they still didn't know where he was. He gives them a call and asks for help. He says, I'm a drug addict. I would like to get help. Help me figure this out. Uberoth decides to name him one of the six players, of course. So he's out of baseball, and he winds up on the San Jose Bees. The last one I'll tell you is this one probably could get cut out if you have to. But Daryl Thomas, he was a 15-year veteran utility player, mostly with the Los Angeles Dodgers. And even though he was a utility player, he was very arrogant. And he rubbed everyone the wrong way, least of all, Harry Steve. He would, every time Steve would make a decision, Steve would counter with, that's not the Dodgers' way. And he did not even make it to the season opener. Some of the other players include Kenny Foster. He was a career minor leaguer, and that's not the reason why he wound up on the San Jose Beats. He was a big guy, imposing, muscular. He always had a scowl, and people were very afraid of him. The reason he was there was because he was Mike Norris's friend, and one of the things that happened to Mike Norris as he was falling down was that, as it happens with many, he got DUIs, he got DWIs, and he cannot drive. Kenny Foster is only there for one reason. Even though he was a baseball player one time, he's not very good. He's only there because he has a car, a green gremlin named Bess. Unfortunately, Bess is not all that great, kind of like everyone else in this story. Even the cars have their issues. But we'll get back to Kenny Foster. Steve McCaddy, not all these players were players who had problems. Some of them were just players who couldn't play in the majors anymore because they weren't that good anymore. Steve McCaddy in 1981, he was a 20-game winner. And he just wasn't as good anymore. He was completely clean and sober. He wound up on the San Jose Bees and was actually one of the better Bees. His story? Fine. We have Fernando Arroyo. He's another pitcher who was just washed up. He had 7 years in baseball with a 24-37 record. And he could go on to be the Bees opening day pitcher. He also slept in his truck, by the way. Then there's Darryl Cias, who I hope I'm saying his name right. He was a career minor league catcher, but he did have 19 days in the show with the A's. I remember having his baseball card. So the only reason why I knew going in was that he was actually a major leaguer at one point. He was a free spirit. He had a mustache, shaggy hair. He looked more like he should be singing Margaritaville than he should be playing baseball. He would don his cape. He would jump off walls, and he loved to paint. And he painted the logos on the stadium. And he lived with Wrights and this guy named Stash in a bunker under San Jose Municipal Stadium. They called that place the Stadium Hilton. And Cias painted it and interior designed it as if it were a student dorm complete with a Led Zeppelin poster. And finally, for the sake, we'll have Mike Stash Bogusiak. He was a minor league pitcher who had not played in 10 years. And just before he wound up on the San Jose Bees, he was working as a private detective in Atlanta, taking pictures of people who were cheating on their wives. So let's get to opening day. We know that Thomas, Daryl Thomas, didn't make it to opening day, which is already kind of a bad sign. Moreover, on opening day, Arroyo is pitching, and after his first practice pitch, Cias throws the ball to first. Then he throws the ball to second. He throws the ball to third. And he's throwing the ball with such velocity that Arroyo can only marvel at what Cias is doing in this low look. How did he get here? He's completely confused. The only thing is, doing those hard throws, he throws out his arm. And from then on, he actually has to deliver the ball back to the pitcher, or else he'll just throw it all over the field. At the beginning of the season, despite the fact that the story is almost now completely forgotten, and it was a national story at the time, as I mentioned, at first it seemed to be working. They didn't win as many games as they'd hoped, but the national media covered it, and at first they had fans. But the press turned out to be kind of a double-edged sword, as it painted a team out of control. And while Harry Steve was a showman, he kind of misread the temperature of a lot of the country when it came to drugs, and the agents just say no. After the novelty wore off, while they thought that they would be a road draw, their notoriety did not bring out that many fans. And the fans that it did bring out were trolls, basically. Fans that were just there to boo them. Yes, Lisa Simpson, some fans would come to a gig to boo the people they paid to see. And that was what was happening throughout the California League. In Bakersfield, a game started with a practical joke on Norris, where a few players gathered sideline chalk and shaped it into lines of coke on the mound. He lightly laughed, but the crowd was a little less enthused. At one point, the shortstop, a jittery kid named Sean Scooter Barton, earned the ire of the drunken crowd for his importations to hit it to me. After the game, the whole team dropped their gloves, got into a brawl with four of the fans in the stands. Police came out, fire trucks came out, and unfortunately, Rubaudel wasn't there to see it. The brawl, you know, it became another part of the story. And it didn't end there that night. Unfortunately, those four were also patrons of the bar Barton decided to drink at that night. And before any of the Bees could stop it, he was pummeled nearly to death. Bleeding profusely from the jaw, Bart refused to go to the hospital, so they took him to the team hotel. But the bleeding would not stop, and eventually he had to be taken to the hospital, and his jaw was wired shut. He survived, but it was kind of a microcosm of Bees' whole season. Well, the press had nicknamed them the San Jose Bees and tried to paint the team as a bunch of lovable screw-ups. Their sort of notoriety was less the euphoric goofiness that one sees when in the middle of a high, but more of the sort that one sees when the drugs wear off. The drugs had ravished a lot of their bodies, and the resulting display was more undyingly sad than funny. Also, a lot of them could really not play baseball very well anymore, which was kind of a problem. After 4 games into the season, Stash is released, because as Steve put it, he simply could not pitch anymore. Then we had the story of Mike Norris, Kenny Foster, and Bessie the Car. We can't speak for who it was. Between Norris, Foster, and Bessie, one of them was unreliable, or maybe all three. They blamed the car. But Norris was late enough times to practice, and he was also late to games, and Foster was also not that great a player. So Harry Steve decided he just wasn't worth the trouble. They come in late one too many times, and Steve calls Foster into his office. He closes the door behind him and says that they have to let him go. Foster storms out, and a few minutes later, Norris comes rushing in and asks, Steve, my God, what did he just do? And Harry Steve responds, we had to fire him. And Mike Norris is just all aghast. He says, you just let go the biggest, most feared gangster in all of Oakland, California. So at that point, they're not really sure what to do, and Harry Steve loses a little of his confidence and any confidence. And the next day, Foster comes back, and no one knows what's going to happen. Foster comes in. He immediately collapses on the office couch, bawling. Steve relents, rehires him. And Michael Norris would later say that he exaggerated a little bit the level of gangster that Kenny Foster was. He was actually just sort of a low-level, you know, a drug runner of some sort. But I guess Mike Norris at that point wanted to get the ride still and stay on the team. In any case, Henry Steve rehires him. And this is kind of a pattern with Harry Steve. For all of his type A personality meets Carnival Barker personality, he's a kind guy. He's very understanding. There's a certain sweetness to the guy. Norris would also leave the team later in the season. And when Norris decided weeks later he wanted to come back, Harry Steve brought him back, no questions asked. But of course, Steve Howe was the center of attention and the center of most of the stories, and he knew it, which was a quality that irked a lot of the rest of the team. And it kind of built this team that somehow had all the chemistry and no chemistry at all. Hauser was just waiting for his call back to the majors, and everybody knew it. Just as that call was about to come, Steve got a call from Major League Baseball saying that there was something weird in Howe's test, but they would not say what the weird thing was. So they forbade Steve from playing Steve Howe. And he told Howe that he had to, you know, he heard from the Major League's office that he has to let him go. But a few hours later, he feels bad. And he was also kind of rubbed the wrong way by the vague order. So at 6 p.m. for a 7 game, he calls Howe and asks him if he still wants to pitch today. Howe jumps at the chance, pitches the best game of his life. Next week, he's back in the majors, and he never had a problem again, is what I'd like to say. But in reality, he pitched a so-so game. It was neither good nor bad. And the next day, Steve Howe's drug test came back positive, as in bad, and he was off the team. And a infuriated Major League Baseball informed Harry Steve that he was also no longer managing the team, which apparently, even though it was a team that was not affiliated with any other team, Major League Baseball still had the right to say no, and they were just amazed that anybody had stood up to him and done this. But he was still the GM, and he was still kind of the owner, so he was still around for the rest of the thing. But then Mike Verity did get his chance, and for the rest of the way, he was the manager. How it would turn out would also get more chances. At my estimation, he got 8 chances. He was with the Yankees for a little bit in the 90s and pitched pretty well for a while, but again, fell off the wagon. His 8th and final chance in professional baseball would come with the 1997 Sioux City Canaries. Again, I just love these team names. And the team was run by, guess who?
Harry Steve.
How
do you know at that point?
Howe was, I think he was in his mid-30s. He was pretty young because he started in 1981. I think he was 21 in 1981. So he was in his mid to late 30s.
You know, his original career was short.
Yeah, I guess you forget how young he was because he lived so much life in those 15 years. One interesting and uplifting aspect of the Harry Steve San Jose Bees is exemplified by the story of Ted Milner, who was a one-time prospect center fielder who wasn't really bad, but he noticed something about every team he saw at every level of baseball up to and including the major leagues when he would watch them being broadcast, because he never made the major leagues. Even though we were 40 years past Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier, Black players were still getting stiff in a certain kind of way. If you were a superstar, they would gladly accept you. However, if you found yourself on the bench, you'd be off the team pretty quickly, or at least more quickly than a white player that was equivalent. There were very few Black players on the bench at any level. Okay, this story kind of contradicts itself in my own story here, because we had the 15-year utility infielder Darryl Thomas, which kind of puts that a little in doubt. But the 400-year history of the United States makes me think that there probably is some truth to it.
And you can have one or two players who buck the trend, and that doesn't mean there isn't a trend.
Yeah, of course. The exception that proves the rule kind of thing, right? In any case, early in the season in the mid-80s, he was doing well, but not well enough. He was released. I'm going to leave the manager's name out of it because the manager claims it's never happened. But in any case, he thought he was blackballed. The pitcher, the coach claims he loved him, but that's up to you. It's too, he said, he said. He did not have a drug problem, but he still wound up on the Bees. He noted the Bees were one of the least white teams he'd ever played on, and he partially attributed that to Harry Steve. Unfortunately, Milner wasn't very good. And Steve, regrettably, at one point did have to let Milner go. He was bad enough for that. And Milner was clearly distraught and was sad that he would have to go back to his family, a family who looked up to him as the big ball player in the family. And now he was going to have to go back to them as an ex-athlete. He had a more practical problem in that he had no means to get home. Harry Steve gave Milner his car and told him to bring it back only when he didn't need it. On the way home, Milner was driving through tears. He got pulled over, and this could have gone so, so wrong for so many obvious reasons. Thankfully, the cop empathized and said, drive safely, and Milner went on to his next chapter. And a bit of a spoiler alert on this one, his story does end really well, and kind of cinematically, too. It's going to be great in a caption. And there are tons more of these stories, but you get the basic idea. In 1987, there were only three of the ex-Major League Baseball players left. Wrightsy, as he liked to be called, McCaddy, and most shocking of all, Darryl Skonyers. That team was 33-109, and as we mentioned earlier, perhaps one of the worst professional baseball teams to ever suit up. By 1988, the grand experiment was long gone with the wind. The San Jose Bees would become an affiliate of the San Francisco Giants, and the Bees' name was retired forever. The 1986 San Jose Bees won more games than any other 80s version of the Bees, but they were still under 500. They were still in last place, and they were not significantly more of a draw than past versions of the team. However, there was some good news for Harry Steve. He did not have to pay his boss the $25,000. And that's the end of my story. So there's more to it, but that can come out in the
But there's so much as it is.
Yeah.
Like, I almost feel like you could do a movie that's really crowded with incident and lots of like insane, funny things happening. Or you can almost do a series and just pull out like every one of these players for an episode.
And it's also, you could come at it in many different ways. I mean, it could be kind of a madcap story, as you mentioned too, but it also could be kind of a gritty and sad story of what happens after the glitter fades, after the crowds aren't watching anymore. Because a lot of the story was crazy and zany and weird. However, it was also kind of, ultimately at its core, sad.
Well, on that note, who do you see directing this? Because that depends a lot on the tone. Because you could do this as like a zany comedy, or you could do this as not bleak necessarily, but kind of a tragedy with, I don't know, I guess a tragicomic movie where, you know, these people have made bad choices and it's coming back to haunt them, but there's also an absurdity to it. Or you can just straight up play the absurdity. So who do you think is the best person to capture that?
Well, that's the thing. And I've actually thought of this in multiple different ways, in multiple different tones. And I think that if you want to go with the absolute zany madcap, and maybe this is just because I don't know as many modern versions of this kind of thing, but if I really wanted to play it for ridiculous laughs, I might go with Savage Steve Holland. Do you remember him by any chance?
Oh, I know that name.
He created CatDog. But before that, he was the director of one of my all-time favorite movies of the 1980s. I stand up behind it as a great film and not just a funny comedy, Better Off Dead. And he also did One Crazy Summer. It was the John Cusack movie. I remember in the trailer, it had the line, "What a waste of a good white guy." It had the "I want my $2." And all the characters were ridiculous. And there were cartoon characters talking to real people. It had Curtis Booger Armstrong.
It was basically like just a John Hughes movie, yeah. Which is with you. It wasn't even a spoof of it. It was just that the absurdism was cranked up at the expense of everything exactly. else. It was like if like the guys who made Airplane directed a John Hughes movie.
And that's, I thought about the guys from Airplane too. Partially I take them out because they also did the Not Another Teen movies and all those awful, awful aughts movies.
Yeah, I think the team of like Zucker, Abram, Zuckerman, one or two of them are doing those terrible spoofs, and one or two of them are like, one of them is a like conservative nutcase.
Yeah, I heard about that too. And that's being charitable. That always kills me. But you've hit upon the thing. I couldn't quite figure out why I wouldn't go with the Airplane trio. And you hit it perfectly. I didn't want that kind of thing. I wanted John Hughes born large and broad and with every level of absurdity.
I had two directors for two different tones. If you want to just play up the absurdism and just make this a silly, energetic comedy, I came with Jorma Taccone, who directed like MacGruber and Popstar Never Stopping, because I feel like those movies are kind of kinetic enough that you don't want somebody like Paul Feig directing the Ghostbusters reboot, where he can direct people standing around and talking, but he can't really direct action. You want this, like the reason Major League is one of the best baseball movies, like comedy or not, is because mm-hmm. if you strip out all the jokes, and it's like the skeleton of it still works as a baseball movie. There's some legitimately mm-hmm. great baseball moments in there. The fake called shot at the end where he calls a shot and everybody backs up and he bunts. Like, that's a great baseball moment. And so mm-hmm. you need somebody who is going to be able to make it work as a baseball movie a little bit. And he isn't, not like he's done any sports movies, but I feel like he can at least give the movie a little bit of action and moving around, but also make it really silly and kind of keep the jokes coming.
That's interesting because the person who I thought about also for this kind of thing, it's a little bit more modern, was from the same world and runs in pretty much the same circles, also comes from the Saturday Night Live team, would be Andy McKay. I think he would also do that. I mean, it wouldn't quite fit the baseball moments necessarily.
Oh, it's really funny because Adam McKay was my very next.
Oh, no kidding.
That was my other. So if we both have him on our list, that might make him the guy because he's done movies like The Big Short where, like this, somebody comes up with a scheme, they're in over their head, it all falls apart, you know, but he plays up the absurdism of these sort of terrible people doing bad things. Mm-hmm. But I remembered him as doing a lot of Will Ferrell sports movies because he had a whole string of them. He actually only did Talladega Nights, but even that is, I think, enough bona fides that I think he kind of covers all the angles here because he can do the silliness, he can do the tragedy, and he can do, you know, he has a little bit of sports movie experience. So yeah, I think, and mm-hmm. if we both came up with Adam McKay, I think he's probably the guy to do this.
Also in the Big Short, he proved that he was good at one other thing came up in my conversation there. He's good at explaining things that don't make sense. There's that Margot Robbie scene in the bathtub where she's explaining how whatever it was works. I guess how The Big Short works.
Right, right.
And yeah, and he was able to figure out how to get around it and get your mind off of things so that you could actually maybe understand this complicated notion. Also, that movie isn't grounded in time. And one of the things I noticed with this story is there are so many moving parts to it. There are so many different little elements of it. I didn't even get to Higante, the mascot, who I can't find any information on, but I want to know more about Higante, the mascot, who was replaced by Crazy George when the San Jose Giants came in, and he was the one who was credited with creating the wave. So you can send your angry letters to Crazy George. But I think Andy McKay, what I thought was brilliant about The Big Short was he took this story that had so many different elements, so many different characters, and was able to jumble up. This is a story that does not have to be told in chronological order. I think a lot of it helps with jumping from time frame to time frame to time frame, going into the future, going into the back, and coming up with crazy little gimmicks. I mean, gimmicks kind of discounts it more than I want to discount it, but I like his gimmicks. I think his gimmicks work.
And you could start with, you know, sort of the team on opening day, or in training, and then you flash back on each of these individual players and like, oh, this is what they did to end up on the Bees.
Yeah, exactly.
But he also did Vice, and that has a pretty sprawling cast of characters. Yeah. So they're all very distinctly awful people in their own ways. And but he also did like the Other Guys and Step Brothers and Anchorman, and he has a pretty unbeatable comedy, you know, resume.
And one thing I notice is that in the nonfiction ones that he does, he doesn't do that thing that I sort of hinted at that I really don't like. He takes the actual, he finds the absurdity in the true story. And he makes the craziness, he alters it in the way that he tells it. He doesn't do like what the director of Bohemian Rhapsody did, where he takes everything, all the songs out of order and makes up a story that maybe it's compelling, but it's not as compelling as Queen's actual life if you told the story in order and all the things don't happen right before they're about to play Live Aid. He doesn't get, you know, AIDS and the band breaks up. The band was on tour right before that. But anyway, I digress with my hatred of Bohemian Rhapsody. Can I do one quick sidebar before we settle on McKay? Because I think we're settled on McKay.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But I do have a choice for if we wanted to go really dark.
Oh.
And it's a fairly obscure director, but his name is Bruce McDonald. Do you know about him? He's a Canadian director. He directed...
I thought I knew him and I was conflating two different kids in the hall.
Yeah, that's right. There's
Kevin McDonald in there. So no, I'm sorry. What did Bruce McDonald direct?
Oh yeah. So Bruce McDonald, his big breakthrough movie was a movie called Hardcore Logo. So this is a movie that is about a punk band 20 years later, 20 years after they had a cult success, they get back together to do one last tour, which sounds like a movie that, it sounds like a familiar another movie, and they did market it that way, which is one of the worst things that the marketing team did. It's not the punk rock. This is Spinal Tap. So I watched this movie. One of the characters is a hardcore punk rock guy from the 1970s, crusty, definitely sort of right between Johnny Rotten and Sid Vicious, always falling apart, very obnoxious and loud, and controls the rest of the band. The second guy was a guy played by Callum Keith Rennie, who in the interim had been in a band called Jennifer, who had alternative pop, like Marcy Playground type success. Or maybe better than Ezra. So they were not huge, but were well enough known that he was a name and he was a little bit like, kind of uncomfortable coming back to the movie. And the movie starts off with the humor in the time past and being fish out of water, being a punk rocker from the 70s and the 1990s. And it's funny. And then all of a sudden it goes into this mescaline fueled, there's a killing of a goat in a motel. And you know, the drummer has all these metaphysical diary entries as the bus slowly goes along the road. And if you haven't seen the movie Hardcore Logo, you might want to move up about a minute or 2 minutes in this podcast, because I can't tell this without spoiling it. It's an engrossing movie. So at this point, I'm in the theater. I'm actually standing up, but I don't mind that I'm standing up. I am so into this film. And it seems like it's a random scene. The front man is just talking to the camera. It's in a street in New York City in front of a club. I mean, you and I have seen it this so many times. You think you're in the middle of the movie. All of a sudden, he says, "You want to see something funny?" Pulls a gun that you've never seen before, shoots himself. The movie fades to black.
Oh.
Yeah. I just sort of stood there stunned. The credits rolled. I kind of wandered outside and was wandering completely forlorn around the streets of Tribeca. And I mean, if you really wanted to go, because there are some dark things, and you know, the codas, some of them end well, some of them don't. And I mean, that's sort of where I'd like to end up when we, as we talk about this, is
like the coda for the Bees players.
Yes, exactly. And Harry Steve, he's okay.
Well, that brings us around to, who do you see playing these various Bees? I don't know who to start with.
Well, I mean, to me, I only really have a couple of people who I need to have. And one of the problems I have here is I just don't know the 20-year-olds on this one. I would almost like populate it with a bunch of Chris's, you know?
That's the running thing on this podcast. I always joke I don't know young actors, so I just pull the cast of Stranger Things. And in fact, I'm actually doing that for one.
Oh, here. I can see Finn Wolfhard being... well, he wouldn't be Grizzle, but he would be a turn for him.
I mean, to my mind, a lot of these players are washed up, so they feel like they're a little bit older than...
You have to be a little, yeah, then they're going to be older than they look.
Because, like, Finn Wolfhard, like, the kids in Stranger Things are still... They're still teenagers. Like, they're still really young. I actually had Joe Keery, who plays Steve on Stranger Things, as Steve Howe.
Okay. Because I had Miles Teller, but so that's kind of in the same vein.
Yeah. Like, he looks a little like him. He kind of has a big square head and is kind of a, like, kind of affable-looking guy, but who you could kind of see as being a likable screw-up.
It doesn't matter who, but I would definitely put Chris Pratt as one of these. He's just a baseball player, so.
Oh, that's true. That's good, yeah. For a lot of these players, we don't, you know, like the public don't really have a great sense of what any of these players look like, or even who a lot of them are. So you can really just plug in actors who you know can be funny and look like they could be baseball players who have gone to seed.
And Moneyball is one of those films that got it completely wrong for the sake of telling a good story. You can almost kind of forgive that one because it does do it very well. But
and it's kind of less about the baseball than any other baseball movie.
Yeah, it's all about the money. And that's where Jonah Hill did a good job in that movie. But one thing about it is they've completely forgotten Moneyball, that the Oakland A's actually had an amazing pitching staff that year, which really helped. They had three of the best pitchers in baseball, but they focused on, you know, mediocre catcher that they got the most out of because of analytics. Right. But that's just my hatred of Moneyball.
But
anyway,
they have to finish the story to make it work, to tell the story they want to tell. And you don't have to do that here.
Yeah, in this case, that's one of the beautiful things that I don't know why it's not a movie, is that, you know, this is something where you don't have, maybe that's the problem. Maybe it's one of those things that's just too unbelievable that they don't even touch it, or they just don't know about it. We'll tell ADBK.
It's not that well known a story. So what other actors do you like? Is there anybody in particular you had?
Okay, well, the first two that I want to cast, to me, the two lead characters would be Harry Steve. And for him, I have one person in mind and one person only, and it's somebody who has not acted in a single movie yet. He did have a TV show, and it's John Mulaney.
Huh. That's funny. I had him in my notes, too.
Harry Steve or for someone else?
Yeah, because I saw Harry Steve as, like, he's only 30 when all this happens.
Yeah.
And so I see, like, a young-looking guy who can come across as being super, like, really professional and somebody you would trust to put in charge of something.
Yeah.
And then you realize that he's not somebody you should put in charge of anything. And unfortunately, there's a connection to cocaine because Mulaney's in rehab right now.
Yeah. But did not see that one coming.
Probably somebody who understands this world better than...
Yeah. And there's a meta thing going on with that to a certain degree, where even he would probably kind of appreciate that sort of thing. He calls himself... He doesn't look like somebody who used to do anything. he also calls himself a tall child. And if you look at a picture, there's a great picture of Harry Steve where he's sitting in the dugout with, you know, shades, sun of shades. And it's just exactly the Harry Steve you would expect from reading about him. And in all ways, I mean, he's not really a caricature of himself. He's actually a very interesting guy. There's a certain kindness. There's a certain, and Mulaney exudes that in spades.
Well, that's the thing. You can see him very easily being a guy who's kind of in over his head and is kind of a screw up, but is also just a fundamentally like decent guy and like giving players his car and that sort of thing. Hmm. Yeah. You can see all sides of that.
Yeah, I could see him as a schemer, and I could see him as a absolute gem of a guy, which is not something
exactly.
You would say.
And I had, like, with McKay, I was thinking Steve Carell, except he's too old.
Yeah, he came to mind, too. Exact same.
But he has all those qualities. And then with Jorma Taccone, I immediately went to his muse, Andy Samberg.
That's another one I had on my list.
Yeah, but he's that same, like, kind of, you know, large child energy.
Yeah.
And somebody who plays lovable screw-ups very well. And he's also somebody who you could probably throw in as one of the players if you wanted to.
Yeah.
Like, I don't necessarily find Mulaney as an athlete, but I think Samberg, you probably could do.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think he did have sort of a sports past too, like long ago. But I think also if you're going with Jorma Taccone or you're going with Andy McKay, you have a lot of Saturday Night Live people. It sort of struck me. Daryl Thomas, he's a small character, but he could be an interesting kind of thing. It could be, I think, a very unique, genre-defying turn for Kenan Thompson.
Wait, remind me, who was Daryl Thomas?
Daryl Thomas was the one. He goes way back. I think I sort of even said, you might not even need this guy for the story. in a sense, he's part of the story because he's the first guy to get kicked off the plane. He was a utility infielder for 15 years with the Dodgers. He's one of those guys you got in every pack of Topps or Fleer Donruss baseball cards. You were going to get a Daryl Thomas. His name even is just a common. But he was one of the big gets, but I mean, he was at a point where he had had some drug issues and wound up on the 86 Bs. And even though he was just a utility infielder, he had earned four nicknames. Two of them were Junkyard Dog and Hot Dog. And if you're a utility infielder and you get the name Hot Dog, you got to have one hell of an ego. And he was the one earlier on I mentioned. He was, this would be kind of, I think, a great scene between Kenan Thompson and John Mulaney. They act together well already. We've seen that in the lobster scene, especially.
Well, that also reminds me of something you mentioned over email before we started recording, that one of the players' names was Hot Dog, and one of them's name was Throw Baby.
Throw Baby, yes. I forgot to mention Throw Baby.
So we got to have Throw Baby in there. I don't know who plays him. But the only other specific people that I just had actors for, I felt like Mike Norris was, of the players, he was one of the more important ones.
Yes, and he's my second lead. He is my second lead.
Yeah, yeah. And for some reason, I landed on Jay Farrow, speaking of SNL people.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't know why, but he's, I think just that I saw a picture of him recently where he's in surprisingly good shape. Like, he looks like somebody who could be a pretty good baseball player. And he also just somebody who I really liked on SNL, and I didn't feel like he got, like, enough chances on that show.
Yeah, me too. Also, I would love him to be on there, because nobody knows who Mike Norris is, really. He doesn't have mannerisms that everybody knows, those mannerisms like Denzel Washington or Barack Obama. This would be his chance. As you said,
we know he can do impressions, but it'd be nice to see him, like, create a character.
He had a movie out recently where I think he was outside of his comfort zone. Unfortunately, I have not seen it. I wish I could remember the title of it, but I was excited to watch it. And then as things go, I just forgot.
Also, I actually have a couple more specific people. You mentioned at the very beginning, the Japanese acupuncturist who was also the pitching coach and slapped the players.
Yeah.
I wanted to see Masioka from Heroes.
Okay.
Because
I'd like to see a bit more roles.
I liked him on that. He's funny. He hasn't really been in a lot. He was like, he had a supporting role in Hawaii Five-0 for the last decade, and that's kind of all he's done. And so he's just somebody who, like, he's likable. You can see him just kind of chewing the scenery as this, like, you know, super serious acupuncturist who just slaps the players when they get out of line. Like, I think he had a lot of fun with that, and he would be really fun in the role. And I have somebody else who you didn't mention on the podcast so far, but I think you mentioned an email or something. Steve Howe had a dealer who had a mohawk.
Rooster.
Yes.
Okay, Rooster. Let me go into Rooster.
If you've got an actor for him, then let's hear it.
Okay. I don't know if I have an actor for him. If you have an actor, I would love to hear it.
But if you got more of a story than what I've already said, then tell us first.
So Rooster was this guy who just hung around the team. Nobody knew what his real name was, but Steve Howe would go off to the corner, talk to him for a bit, and then disappear for 3 days. And we all know exactly what he was doing. And the craziest thing about Rooster was that, you know, big mohawk, drug dealer. Now, a lot of the players on this team came from that world, knew everything about it. Mike Norris grew up in kind of a hard environment. He did not even want to go near Rooster. Rooster even scared Mike Norris. So that's about all I have with him. I think that's about all anybody knows about Rooster. He was one of those shady characters that kind of lurked in the corner. And
well, now I don't know if my actor works, because he's kind of a slight guy and I don't know how intimidating he is, but
nobody knows. maybe that's the best thing.
I only just caught up on King of Staten Island, Judd Apatow's movie with Pete Davidson. One of the supporting characters in that, one of the supporting actors, Moises Arias. He started off as a child actor. He was in The Middle. He was on Hannah Montana. But in that movie, and just as a 20-something, he just played a convincing dirtbag who still had this kind of wide-eyed, like, innocence and just seemed like, you know, like a not necessarily a bad guy, but just a kid who doesn't have his head on straight or whatever. So I don't know. I liked him in that film in a small role and thought he could pull off a mohawk too. But maybe you want somebody a little tougher, a little more.
I'm actually going to go with somebody who's not tougher, but who I think would be very interesting in the role. And we're going a little older with this one. I'm going with Kevin Corrigan. There's just something about him that it's the creepy level on there that I think would work. It's sort of his character from Buffalo 66, where, I mean, it's just kind of a stoner, whatever.
Well, but it's funny, he was also in King. Was also in King Staten Island because, of course, you have to, like, if you're doing this kind of movie, you have to have Kevin Corrigan in it.
Mm-hmm.
But, and again, with this baseball movie, if there's a way to get Kevin Corrigan in there somewhere, get him in there somewhere.
I agree. I am always happier when I see Kevin Corrigan. Oh, by the way, Mike Norris, just going back to him, I had for Mike Norris, Michael B. Jordan, but that's not overly exciting. So he's a great actor. Mike Norris is kind of, you know, it's an interesting character, but he's kind of clay that you can mold around and create his character out of that.
I just wasn't thinking that big. Like, can we get Michael B. Jordan for our completely imaginary casting?
I think we can get anyone. Andy McKay, make it work. Come on. You got this. You got this. I want to have somebody for Kenny Foster now. So the person who comes to mind is way too old for it and also dead. he died a couple weeks ago, even in Tiny Lister.
Okay. Well, again, it's imaginary casting.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, Ving Rhames.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, he's way too old for it, let's have a time portal on this one.
We do that often on the show.
I don't know who the actual actor's name is, but he's on The Unicorn right now. Before that, he was on, I believe, Ballers.
I checked IMDb. His name is Omar Benson Miller.
He would be kind of interesting because you could sort of cast against type to make him tough. But then when he breaks down, he's got that teddy bear vibe that I think would work pretty well.
Yeah.
So he could be good. Ken Reitz is one. Ken Reitz is somebody you can actually tag someone a little bit older for. Because Ken Reitz is actually one of the main guys. I guess I just didn't, he's so boring that I don't really. did I mention the Hilton? Yeah, he was one of the members of the Hilton. I mentioned quickly.
All the names blurred together. I forgot which guy he was.
He's one of the few guys who stayed. He's one of the big guys in the Sports Illustrated. All the stories, they sort of center around him because he was kind of the captain of the team. And him, again, I want to go sort of in a back of time and get Tom Berenger. But Tom Berenger's got to be 70 by now.
Well, yeah.
There's got to be someone. Can I just pluck a Chris out of thin air?
You've only got one Chris. Let's put them all in one movie.
Yeah, so that's what all the Chris's in there. And even Chris's that we don't know yet can come in there. Christopher Mintz-Plasse, let's bring him in there.
There you go. Tucker. Let's just every Chris.
Chris Tucker. Chris Tucker would be good for Daryl Scott, actually. Again, a little too
I mean,
old,
I think he's like 50 now.
Yeah.
So I didn't have anybody else for any specific roles other than one of these guys to be Throw Baby. but it's one of these, because it's an ensemble, it's one of those things you can just plug in. You know, anybody who you think who's like young and funny and could play a like coked up baseball player and you just want to see, you know, do more work. And as male, because unfortunately there aren't any women in this movie at all.
Or we could really stunt cast if we want to.
There you go.
Melissa McCarthy, come on in.
Yeah, burn it on Sherla as a washed up baseball player from the...
Oh, that would I would pay to see that movie. So what were the other actors you have?
Yeah, I didn't have any particular characters other than that somebody has to be Throw Baby. I mean, come on.
Yeah. But what were the other characters?
But I just came with a list of people who I thought like could be good in this. And so it just kind of random list of people like Ron Funches, Ryan Hansen from Party Down, who again is like good playing a likable dumb guy.
Dirk, yeah. From Veronica Mars too.
Yeah, that's true. Mikey Day from SNL.
He could be. I mean, he's almost 40. He could be Ken Reitz. I think he would be perfect for
that. There you go.
To get him as a star making turn.
And my last name is Jesse Plemons, who we've never seen him do any comedy, but he's a fantastic actor. He sort of has the build to be an ex-athlete, and I feel like he could really be great in this kind of comedy. Maybe as somebody who's not necessarily a straight man, but like somebody who's funny because they're like deadly serious and intimidating.
The Plemons, I loved on. I mean, Plemons is also so versatile too. I loved him. I fell in love with him on Friday Night Lights. He was like 16 years old. He was the only person in that cast that was the right age, or even close.
Right.
Everyone else is in their late 20s.
He's so young, and he has that, and Breaking Bad, and Fargo, and like he's been so good in so many things already.
Jesse Plemons, Rooster. We've got our Rooster.
Actually, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely what you think. And Ron Funches, you hit the perfect one for Kenny Foster, because he can walk in. If you don't know Ron Funches, I don't know. But can we make Ron Funches? I want to make Ron Funches tough. That's the thing.
Well, yeah, yeah.
I want him cast against type for that part, because when he starts bawling, he would be so perfect for that.
Oh, yeah.
That's when he breaks down and turns, yeah.
No, he could do that so well. That would be cool. Wait, yeah. He could do that turn so well.
Who was the other guy in the list? I want to give him a part. I don't want to leave anybody on the cutting room floor here.
That was Ryan Hansen from Party Down.
Oh, Ryan Hansen from Party Down. Okay.
You'd already given him a shout out.
Yeah, yeah. So he's, no, I know exactly who he is. He is the Jimmy Buffett. Just grow out the hair. Oh,
there you go. Yeah. Just
grow out the mustache.
Put a wig on him and there you go.
He looks 1970s as it is. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
There's something perfectly 1970s about his look. I think that's what has worked for him throughout his career, because he's always a little bit out of there. He's conventionally handsome, but he's conventionally handsome in a 1970s, almost Richard Thomas way. And I could see him singing Margarita.
All right, well, those are our actors, and that's our baseball team, and I think that's our movie.
The one thing that I wanted, or that you were going to...
No, I was doing the outro, so if you have any more to say it now.
Okay. Oh, okay. So, at the outro, this is actually kind of perfect, because there's a way I would want to end the movie. I know the end. I'm going to talk Adam McKay into it. It's not negotiable. So, remember the Jimmy Buffett-looking guy who, you know, liked to jump off of walls and was the free spirit? That was Darrell Seas. He was a painter, and he painted a mural where all the players signed in on it, and it's still there today underneath the San Jose Municipal Stadium where the San Jose Giants play. You know, there's pictures of it online if anybody wants to look at it, look it up. And it's kind of nice. So that would be the thing I would definitely close on, a picture of him doing the mural, and then it would stop to a freeze, and then we would have the CODAs. And we start with Mike Norris. Mike Norris would actually make it back to the major leagues as a relief pitcher in 1990, 7 years after his last major league appearance. He won one game before he had to have spinal cord surgery in 2000. And he was one of the ones, and part of why he is one of the main characters, is ultimately his story ends up okay. He undergoes the spinal cord surgery and he's out of baseball. And what his takeaway on cocaine was, there are three things you can look forward to with cocaine: hospitalization, incarceration, and death. I'd done two of the three. The only thing left was death. It was the next step. The only way out of the misery, the madness. As it happens, this would probably be the last one that we would get to of all of them.
Yeah, that's like the misery, the mad. Like, that's a good
note. That's a good close. That is definitely a good close. So Norris's baseball career ended. He had spinal cord surgery in 2000, but he's raising an 18-year-old daughter who would now be 22. He runs a youth foundation in Oakland. And he's writing his memoirs. This is another way that would be a great ending for it. A sample chapter, which addresses how Ubaroff handled the cocaine problem, is titled "The Czar Who Went Too Far." Steve Howe was suspended 7 times out of baseball. As we mentioned, his 8th chance would come, and this would probably not be in the movie. This would be in this card. He finished his pro career with the 1997 Sioux Falls Canaries, which was an independent team run by Harry Steve. And, you know, so he lived on and his life never really got that much better. And on April 28th, 2006, he was driving along. You can't make this kind of thing up. He was driving in Coachella, California. His car rolled over and he died at the age of 48, just a few months older than I am now. The autopsy, of course, found meth in his system. So Steve Howe did not have a great end. Darryl Skonnears would play 4 more minor league seasons. Never got back to the major leagues. His last known whereabouts were San Bernardino County, California, homeless. 2014, this would be the one that would be the final card for him. In 2014, Darryl Skonnears Jr. was convicted of first-degree murder. Darryl Thomas operates a nonprofit youth league in the Riverside area. Ken Wright's is the story that ends up the best. He only hit 209 in 1987 and never played baseball again. He was 35 years old. He's been sober since 1988. He lives in St. Louis. He plays golf and he assists the Cardinals in local events and works for Major League Baseball. If you go to his Wikipedia page, there's nothing about drugs or alcohol at all. He's just this guy who played a mediocre career, but, you know, pretty good. And his life is okay.
And he could be a fascinating character in this movie, that he's kind of the normal guy.
Yeah.
Who just likes baseball and isn't great at it. but it's good enough and just surrounded by all these like nutcases.
And he was really drunk most of the time, apparently, during the 1986 year.
Oh, okay.
But who wouldn't have been? He could still be, I think, in that level. Back to Tom Berenger. That kind of works for that. So if we could sign up 1987 Tom Berenger, we'd be in business. Fernando Arroyo made it back to the major leagues in 1986. He made his first major league appearance in 4 years. He pitched to 3 batters, walked all of them, forced in 2 runs. He got back to his hotel room and was released immediately. But his story actually became great. The connection there, he became a pitching coach in Japan and many other places during his career. And he invented a throwing training device called Arm Track, which I just think is a perfect ending. Steve McCaddy is the pitching coach for the Lake County, Ohio Captains, Class A affiliate of the Cleveland Indians. That's a quick one that flashes through the screen. Ted Milner is one of the best ones. After his release from the 1986 Bees, he played minor league ball for the Angels in 1987 and the Indians in 1988. Never made it back, but he's the president and founder of the Black Baseball Players Association and president of Executive Temps, an entertainment employment agency in Los Angeles. He places people in jobs in the entertainment industry. And when he needs athletes from team sports, he knows they understand the value of team. So he can actually, Ted Milner can actually help us cast this show. If I had known that early enough, maybe we could have called Ted Milner if he could have been the guest on the show. Harry Steen just basically spends his entire career in minor league baseball. And in 2011, he finally quit because nobody would hire him anymore. But okay. It was a relatively good career. But there's no really good title card for him from this. We'd have to write one. And I'm not up to that quite yet.
I think that's actually just it. After managing this disaster of a team, like he's still a minor league baseball manager, and like,
yeah,
kind of.
He didn't regret anything. Like
he's the stable one, weirdly.
Yeah. Hopefully, he has some sort of quote that says he doesn't regret a thing. And if he doesn't, we're gonna have to tell him he said that, because I think that could be the second to last. And then back to Mike Norris. Mike Norris would definitely finish. It was the next step, the only way out of the misery, the madness. Before we end this, I definitely want to give credit to Tom Verducci, who wrote the Sports Illustrated. It's an amazing article written on the 30. It's not the original article I read. It's even better because it tells the story after the story. There's like 8 or 9 different stories that I looked into that were told around the time.
It's still up there on SI.com if anybody wants to check it out.
Yep, it is. It's really good. It's definitely a great read. It has a lot more, believe it or not, than we talked about in this podcast.
This story is an onion. You just keep peeling away at it. There's more.
Yeah.
But as far as making a movie, having too much story is a better problem than not having enough.
Of course, of course.
Especially for comedies, frankly. Because oftentimes we try to stretch out a thin premise to get, you know, 2 movies out of Wayne's World or whatever. It was a 5-minute sketch. When it's actually kind of, it's good to have, you can pack every moment of this with incident and with jokes because there's just so much material.
Yeah, it really works on so many levels. And I that's part of what I loved about it, was that you could attack the movie in so many different ways. We both noticed that. We both came to that conclusion that you had to have multiple directors for multiple ways that you wanted to take the story.
Oh, yeah. And it can be a tragedy. It can be a comedy. You can play up all those things. And I think ending with the Mike Norris quote about the madness and everything, like, it's actually okay, I think, to make this a really sort of absurd, silly story and still end on that somber note, because at the heart of this, this is a really tragic story for a lot of these guys.
As it is with all the great comedies, there's a little bit of sadness. There's a reason why Charlie Chaplin is the one who wrote Smile Though Your Heart Is Breaking. It's because that's what's at the center of comedy. And that's also why comic actors are often the best at playing tragic actors or playing just standard drama. They know the timing. They know the certain kind of sadness behind the eyes that want to always find the humor in a moment.
And so much comedy comes as a way of dealing with pain and tragedy and
trying
to make sense of madness. And that's kind of the heart of this. So I think that's our movie. Thanks again to Jason Thurston. If you have any thoughts on minor league baseball, cocaine, or ideas for any movies that need to get made, hit us up on Twitter at YMovie. You can find my column, Wiki Wormhole, in the AV Club every Sunday. You can hear Real College Radio and read articles on our parent website, subjectmedia.org. You should check out Jason's website, screenscholars.com. Look out for Screen Scholars' new podcast in the next couple of weeks. Oh, and watch his music video show, 133 Minutes, also on subjectmedia.org on Fridays. And keep wearing a mask. Keep yourself sane. We'll be back next time on...
Why is this not a movie?